طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem conducted an investigation and issued a report documenting that Israel is an apartheid state by international legal standards. It lies at the base of a wide array of Israeli policies, advancing and perpetuating the supremacy of one group, Jews, over another, Palestinians. B'Tselem rejects the perception of Israel as a democracy inside the Green Line that simultaneously upholds a temporary military occupation beyond it. B'Tselem reached the conclusion that the bar for defining the Israeli regime as an apartheid regime has been met after considering the accumulation of policies and laws that Israel devised to entrench its control over Palestinians. The key tool Israel uses to implement the principle of Jewish supremacy is engineering space geographically, demographically, and politically. Jews go about their lives in a single contiguous space where they enjoy full rights and self-determination. In contrast, Palestinians live in a space that is fragmented into several units, each with a different set of rights, given or denied by Israel, but always inferior to the rights accorded to Jews. This Week in Palestine features this week a forum on this courageous report, which took place in Cork, Ireland. It is moderated by the chair of the Cork County Anti-Apartheid Campaign, Martin Shield, and features Haggai El-Haj, Executive Director of B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization which issued the report, and Ronnie Kasriel, former South African minister and anti-apartheid activist. Because of time restrictions, we will broadcast the third panelist, Mazen Kumsia, on This Week in Palestine next week. We begin this week with introductions by moderator Martin Shield.
Thank you very much, Cathy, for that introduction. The focus of this evening's meeting is the B'Tselem report, This is Apartheid. And we have three very prominent speakers to speak to this issue. As Cathy says, I was the chairperson of Cork Anti-Apartheid during the period of South African apartheid. And in 2019, I had the opportunity to visit the occupied Palestinian territories, along with a number of Cork people. When we saw the B'Tselem report, which was released earlier this year, we felt that this report was a very good description of what we had seen, felt, and heard while we were in Palestine. And we were very determined that this report should be brought to the broader attention of people in Cork and in Munster, particularly because one of our local TDs, Simon Coveney, is the Minister for Foreign Affairs during a period when Ireland has a position on the Security Council, and obviously also the Taoiseach Micheál Martin is a local. So it is a great pleasure that I hand you over to the executive director of Bethlehem, Haggai Elad, who will give us a description of the of that report and his findings and why Bethlehem came to this decision. So over to you, Haggai. Thank you very and welcome to Cork.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for the organizers and for everyone that's attending this evening. It's a big audience. I appreciate people taking their time. And also very much looking forward to listening to the other distinguished panelists this evening. So thank you, everyone. Going to the apartheid report, to say this is such a dire and painful reality. One that, you know, is often mistakenly related to as the status quo, quote unquote. But there's nothing static in this reality besides the fact that this injustice is allowed to proceed with impunity decade after decade. Yesterday was a day in which more than 20 Palestinians lost their homes in the West Bank as a result of an Israeli spate of demolitions all over the occupied territories. It doesn't even make the news. Right. So just imagine the way this reality plays day in and day out at the expense of the rights and freedoms of millions, while again, rarely making the news or attracting any attention domestically or internationally. And there are the visible aspects of this reality and also like the invisible ones. I mean, talking not about only the bulldozers and the walls, but also about invisible aspects of Israeli control and oppression of Palestinians, like the permits regime and the bureaucratic aspects of this control. So I'm hoping that for the viewers this evening, this background is very much within your eyesights as you're listening to all of the comments this evening in an effort to try and, share with you, not just analysis, but also try and give as close as possible a flavor of what it is to live under this kind of oppressive regime and for such a long time and for so many people. Bethlehem itself, we've been around since 1989, so just over three decades by now of our work on human rights in the occupied territories. And for one that has, if you've been following closely the language that we've been using over the years, then you would see that things have changed, things have moved from, period to period. And if in the beginning we would have talked about a temporary occupation, then that switched later to discussing a prolonged occupation and then a one-state reality. And now more recently in January, arriving at apartheid. And these changes in language are a reflection of two aspects. One is it's a reflection of the development of the thinking and the analysis inside the organization. It's also a result of a changing and evolving reality, right? The situation now is not where we were 10 or 20 years ago, right? And that's so not only because an additional decade has passed, and that's significant in and of itself, the passage of time and the further normalization, entrenchment of this unacceptable reality is certainly something that needs to be taken into account, but also the additional facts on the ground that accumulate as one shifts from one decade to the next. The fact that by now Israel has some 700,000 Jewish settlers living in the occupied West Bank and illegally annexed East Jerusalem didn't happen in a day. And it's a figure that also, shouldn't be set aside lightly, not only because that's not a small number, but also because by now that's approximately 10% of the Jewish population between the river and the sea that is already living in the occupied territories. So the situation has evolved, our thinking has evolved, and this is in the face of holding on to some other worldview, which I'll present in a second, which we believe very strongly has long expired and needs to be set aside if we are committed to making a correct analysis that hopefully will also bring about the correct conclusions and the correct actions that need to be taken to negate it. So there is a worldview, right, that looks at the reality within the river and the sea and says, there are two regimes here. There is a permanent Israeli democracy inside the Green Line, and there is a temporary occupation on the other side of the Green Line. So these are two parallel regimes, and if you want to, you know, shorthand this model, then this is a description of this reality as one of democracy plus occupation. And this has been like repeated time and time again. I mean, you can ask yourself, like, how many times have you heard that, right? And obviously, often when invoking the occupation, then, you know, don't really worry about it because it is temporary, and there will be peace negotiations, or there are peace negotiations, and changes right around the corner. So that's the way things are in that false worldview. But to hold on to that worldview, you need to shut out of your, you know, view a growing set of facts. So I already mentioned one of them, which is the fact that 10% of the Jewish population lives in that other side, on that, you know, temporary occupied territory. And those people, those citizens, Israeli Jewish citizens that live there, live as if they're living inside Israel proper, right? With all of the protections and privileges that Israeli law provides. They certainly don't feel the two regimes, right? You need to ignore the fact that actually part of the occupied territory has been officially annexed, right? I mean, you've heard a lot about de facto annexation during 2020 with the Trump plan and so on. But already a long time ago, Israel has formally annexed a chunk of the West Bank, right? The expanded version of what Israel calls East Jerusalem has already been annexed formally a long time ago. So it's really difficult to look at this and say, these are separate regimes, really? But there is an overarching principle, and that's really the core of the matter that you need to ignore if you want to hold on to a two-regime analysis, which is everywhere between the river and the sea, on both sides of the Green Line, what you see is a single government that controls everyone and everything within the river and the sea, and that is conducting itself based on a single principle, which is advancing the interests of Jews at the expense of the rights of Palestinians, right? And if you look closely at Israeli policies since 1948 here, and if you look closely at Israeli policies since 1967 as if there, then you will see that it is the same principle that's been applied by the regime throughout these decades. So we have a reality that by now has been in place for much of the time the state of Israel existed, right? So like 1967 is more than half a century ago. And that's, you know, way, you know, majority of the time the state of Israel itself has existed. And yet, although that much time has passed, we need to somehow pretend that this is temporary. Or we can come to terms with reality and call a spade and appreciate what is actually going on. And there you just see that this fits with the textbook definition of apartheid. There's one group of people. I mean, by now we have a reality of demographic parity, right? There are some 14 million people living between the river and the sea. Half of them Palestinians, half of them Jewish individuals like myself. And yet the regime conducts itself in a way that treats one group in a very different way than the way it treats the other half of the population. In the analysis that we did, that we published in that like very short position paper, we wanted to make it very accessible for everyone to read. It's a 6 or 7 pager in English. There's also even a shorter illustrated version that is about 1,000 words, and that's it. So you can really like read and get a solid grip on it. You know, very, very fast. This was done like with public consumption in mind because we wanted to impact public opinion broadly and to make this accessible, you know, not just to legal scholars, but to like, you know, any decent individual that has an immediate understanding of how injustice looks like and what apartheid is. So allow me first like to make a few points of clarification, because some of the, you know, counter arguments typically come by at this point, or, you know, maybe you're already familiar with some of them. So one is, and I'm speaking now carefully, especially since we have such a distinguished South African colleague on this evening's webinar, that when one says that the reality in 2021, 2022 is apartheid, it doesn't need to be identical to the situation in apartheid South Africa, right? And of course, people, when one mentions apartheid, they do think about the South African experience and the oppression of blacks by South African whites. But since then, apartheid has become an independent political and legal and intellectual term, right? And so when we're saying that this is apartheid, we're not saying that things are identical to South Africa. And in fact, no two historical incidents would ever be identical, right? There will always be differences, but things do not need to be identical to count as apartheid. What needs to be in place is that that essence of the regime, group supremacy of one part of the population at the expense of the other, and the effort to perpetuate that reality, that would make the regime into apartheid. The other point I want to clarify is that when we're describing this regime, we're not saying that the level of oppression of all Palestinians is the same, right? There are differences, and we analyze them with great nuance and accuracy in that short position paper. The level of oppression of a Palestinian who is a citizen instead of Israel, second-class citizen, is not the same as the level of oppression of a Palestinian who is a quote-unquote permanent resident in occupied East Jerusalem, or a Palestinian living elsewhere in the other parts of the West Bank that were not officially annexed, or one of the 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip in what has become one of the largest open-air prisons on the planet. These are different levels of oppression and subjugation and denial of rights. But, and that is the core principle, and that's what we need to focus on, the fact that there are different levels of oppression doesn't diminish from the principle and doesn't change the core headline, that there isn't a single square inch between the river and the sea in which a Jewish individual and a Palestinian individual are equal. Jews are always first class anywhere they live between the river and the sea. Palestinians are always second class or much less, right? That's the structure that the state provides. One structure for Jews, another structure for Palestinians. So again, that's something that needs to be appreciated. In the position paper, we look at the factual way in which this principle is implemented, right? We look at four main pillars of this reality. We look at the re-engineering of space, who controls the land, what happens to land under Israeli control. We look at the re-engineering of demography, what happens to the population. We look at political rights, and we look at freedom of movement. So these are the four aspects that that we analyze. I'll focus only on two of these at this presentation. And again, everyone's invited to read the full and rather short, as I keep saying, position paper. So if you look at control over land, then you will see, again, similar processes happening everywhere under Israel's control. Since 1948, Palestinian land has been taken over by the state and then allocated mostly for the development of towns and infrastructure for Jews. And since 1967, you saw exactly a parallel process happening in the occupied territories. Palestinian land moves to the hands of the state and then allocated for the development of communities and infrastructure for Jewish communities, right? I think it's also interesting to notice the level of Israeli insistence that all this process of land that used to be Palestinian becoming state controlled and then allocated to Jews, the state insists that all this is done properly and legally. And sometimes it's even the same mechanisms, just under different dressings that were used in, you know, since 48 inside the Green Line and since 67 on the other side of the Green Line. So for instance, confiscation of land for military purposes, and then using that pretense to steal that land from its Palestinian owners, and then to allocate that for Jewish towns. That's one of the mechanisms used since 48 inside and since 67 outside, same mechanism. And there's a barrage of additional mechanisms that the state has used, announcements of state land and appropriations and nature reserves and military trainings and what have you. But eventually the reality is the same process and a very similar reality that unfolds in front of our eyes. And in a parallel way, with regard to demographics, the state desires to have more Jews and to have less Palestinians. And this is in effect, again, everywhere in the river and the sea. So a Jewish individual can immigrate to Israel and gain, you know, residency and citizenship and full rights. And they can move to Tel Aviv or they can move to a city settlement, right, somewhere in the West Bank, and it will be all the same, with all of the benefits that the state will provide to encourage that process. And it's exactly the opposite reality for Palestinians. Palestinians, it's almost impossible for a Palestinian to gain status, to immigrate to Israel proper or to the occupied territories, right? And again, same reality, sometimes through, you know, different mechanisms, but everywhere between the river and the sea. And even if we're talking about Palestinians, that, you know, their grandparents were living in Palestine pre-1948, from Israel's perspective, doesn't make any difference, right? People cannot gain residency in the area that Israel control between the river and the sea. So that's the gist of this reality. And you can see the way that this is unfolding year after year, decade after decade. In such a fashion. Towards, you know, concluding this, what I want to say is that the success of this Israeli project stands on 2 feet, right? 1 foot is doing it, right? Re-engineering space and land and demographics and all of the processes that I've described just now. Oppressing Palestinians and advancing the interests of Jews at their expense. That's 1 foot. But the other foot is the foot of impunity, is getting away with it, is doing all this and yet continuously somehow still being considered a democracy, a Western first world economy with all of the international perks and economical benefits that come with that. When we published in January this position paper, we did it first and foremost just because we came to the conclusion, no long after many of our Palestinian colleagues, that this is apartheid. We just wanted to call things as we have come to see them. But we're also hopeful that with the correct analysis, there will be the correct conclusions. We're also hopeful that this will bring about change, that this will end Israeli impunity, that this will impact public opinion and eventually foreign policy, so that finally this unjust situation will be brought to an end and we will finally begin moving towards a very different future, a future which will be based on justice and equality for everyone between the river and the sea. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Haggai. That was a very good outline of what is in the report. Anybody who has registered for this webinar will receive an email afterwards, and included in that will be a link to the position paper that Haggai has been referring to it. And I would urge you to read it. It is very comprehensive and it is a very short document as well. You will get a lot of information in a short period of time. The next person I'm going to introduce to you, our next speaker, is Ronnie Castries, who is a former South African government minister and an anti-apartheid activist. One of the most memorable meetings that we had in Cork while I was chairperson of the anti-apartheid movement was an address by Dennis Goldberg, and that's at a public meeting in Cork in 1986, and he had a great impression on anybody who attended that meeting. Dennis Goldberg was one of the eight leaders of the ANC, who, along with Nelson Mandela, was sentenced to life imprisonment in 1964. 22 years later, he was released from prison, and shortly afterwards, he spoke at a public meeting in Cork City here. He was a great champion, obviously, of the anti-apartheid movement, but also of the Palestinian people. And in 2015, at a conference in Johannesburg, he said very clearly that, in his opinion, he had no doubt whatsoever that Israel was an apartheid state. So with that quote, could I hand you over now to Ronnie Castries and ask him to talk about apartheid in South Africa, apartheid in Israel, and what we can learn from both and how they are connected and possibly some of the differences. Over to you, Ronnie.
Thank you very much indeed, Martin, and all those in Cork, and of course the PSC committee in Cork, to all our friends in Ireland, and to those on the panel with me, Haggai and Mazen, everybody else. It's a great honor and pleasure to be with you at this important meeting. And of course, Dennis, who I knew extremely well before his arrest, we were involved in the underground together. I was one of the lucky ones and managed to escape. And I was very close to him in the years after his release. Was, as you've pointed out, a most magnificent human being. As Jewish people would say, a real mensch, and something that's close to the Irish heart for sure. I agree so much with Haggai in his presentation. And of course, as Dennis Goldberg said, Israel represents exactly what we understand as an apartheid state. The Bethlehem report is absolutely welcome. And as Haggai has said, it doesn't mean that they are identical twins. The United Nations has declared apartheid as a crime against humanity, and that doesn't simply apply to the South African apartheid regime and that system, because it's defined in universal terms as inhuman acts committed for purpose of maintaining the domination of one racial group over others, and systematically oppressing them and maintaining that domination. So it applies universally, and that's extremely important, because as a crime against humanity, decent, fair-minded people of the world and governments should in fact stand against that form of racial discrimination, systematic form, legalized form, wherever it existed. And that's how it's applied in terms of the way we view Israel as a racist, apartheid, colonial state. And that's very, very important indeed in terms of understanding why people around the world, especially those with experience of colonization, raise their voices and their solidarity in practice in relation to what is happening to the people of Palestine. And that's how we in South Africa associate the crimes of Israeli Zionist apartheid. We in South Africa, along with colonized people elsewhere in the world, and we know that Ireland was the first colonial conquest and possession of the English crown, which developed its brutal system of colonization along with other colonial powers throughout the world. It's interesting to note that a South African in 1962, not long after the Sharpeville massacre, said that Israel was an apartheid state, wasn't quite correct in the way he then followed by saying it's an apartheid state like South Africa because the Jews have taken the land of the Arabs who had lived there since the 7th century. Of course, those of us who are intimate with the history of Palestine know that Palestinian people lived there from times immemorial. But what people are surprised by is that the person who leveled that accusation was the architect of apartheid, Hendrik Verwoerd, Dr. Verwoerd, who had studied in Nazi Germany in the late in the early 30s, in Germany before the Nazis came to power, but imbibed everything about the theory of racism and was very instrumental in the ideological development of the Afrikaner nationalists in South Africa, even when they were fighting and struggling for political power against the British and their descendants who were to the fore in South Africa, in ruling South Africa post-1910, when Britain gave independence to the whites, only the whites, to govern South Africa in concert with themselves. 1948 was when the Afrikaner nationalists, with their apartheid ideology, which was a much extremer form of the very brutal form of British colonialism and Dutch colonialism before them, who were the powers in South Africa. So they actually inherited all those colonial laws of oppression and made them even more emphatically racist and brutal. 1948, they came to power in the very, very month, ironically, that the State of Israel was declared. And at a time when, for the reasons, as we well know, the Holocaust, etc., but also when the United Nations was really dominated by former colonial powers, granted Israel what the British had granted the whites in South Africa, really the right to the land. And we then see in that period the ethnic cleansing and the terror regime imposed on the Palestinian people. That dispossession came late in terms of colonial conquest. The rest of the world, including South Africa, Africa, Asia, Latin America, had seen this along with Ireland over the centuries before. The fact that this came late to Palestine does not mean that it's not a colonial racist state. It is colonial in every sense of the word, the dispossession of the people of their land and of their rights in the most brutal, vicious way, and in terms of a process that continues to this day. So South Africans had come along with Dennis Goldberg to see for themselves, and I'm talking about the freedom fighters like him, I'm talking about even fair-minded South Africans, and not everyone from South Africa happens to be fair-minded in terms of race and class questions, for sure. A lot of them, particularly Afrikaners, are, and unfortunately, African, indigenous, black evangelicals caught up in the same mold, swept up along with the evangelicals of America, the United States, are going to Israel. They're not fair-minded. They see it through that particular prism. But any fair-minded South African, and particularly the most outspoken, from Desmond Tutu to a whole host, including Dennis Goldberg, Tutu in 1989 stated that what he saw in Palestine, he was really talking about the occupied territories, was akin to the dispossession of people in South Africa and the measures used against them. He was actually on the mild side of things, because those of us who visited in later years, not that much later, we actually declared and saw for ourselves that it was far more brutal, far more vicious. I remember in 2004, I was a minister at that time of intelligence, and that's security in other countries. But I visited President Arafat in his beleaguered fortress that had been bombed to smithereens around him in Ramallah. I was leading a delegation, and he said to us, look around, and you can see we are in a Bantustan state. And I said to him, Mr. President, you're not in the kind of Bantustan state of South Africa. And he and his people looked at me with bulging eyes. What's this guy talking about? And I said, you know, President Arafat, in South Africa, there are several Bantustans, and four, in fact. And the South African government has never bombed them as they bombed your Ramallah. They've never attacked the people with tanks and planes. They haven't bombed them to smithereens anywhere. In fact, the South African government, in projecting the Bantustans as a way in which apartheid provides special, separate development to the black people, allows them palatial government buildings and even airports so that they can fly from their Bantustans across the world, and where they allow them to set up their offices and their legations in countries that will take them. And that puts pay to that. There's no walls. There hadn't been walls around those Bantustan states. Very often, there were no police at the borders crossing into those Bantustan states. So it's far worse what we see. But of course, what we came to understand is that it's not only in the occupied territories from Gaza to the West Bank, the opened air concentration camp that Haggai and everybody else refers to Gaza, and we know about the absolute brutality meted out there to women, to children, the elderly, and so on. But within Israel itself, which explains why there's such a small number and very important heroic Jews like Haggai, as we had in South Africa, like Dennis Goldberg, who stand up and condemn apartheid and expose it, a very important aspect as I lead into the issue of what lessons can be learned from the resistance, Martin, which you asked me to deal with as well, apart from the similarities. But let me just say that it's so important to expose Zionist Israel as that apartheid state which applies its vicious laws of discrimination by degrees, as Haggai Guinness said, whether it's Gaza or the West Bank in the extreme sense, but within Israel itself, in terms of the third class status. And we'll hear this from our next speaker, Nazem, who's so important internationally in the work that he does. I want to just end this part of what I mean to say, in that with apartheid, the particular laws and legislation were built on what the British had set in place. There was a 1919 Land Act that finally, after the military conquest of the African people's territories in South Africa, that Land Act left the African people with 13% of the land in South Africa. And of course, they were a massive majority over the white settlers. It's always been a figure of about 10% of the white population, another 10% of what's called mixed race, colored people terminology in South Africa, with some a million of the Indian people involved in that. And in relation to the question of population registration, the Land Act, the racial categorization, which is akin to the Nazi Nuremberg laws, the Bantustan program, and the measures of brutality to enforce the system. I want to quickly end in these last few minutes by saying that the incredible parallels in resistance of the people of South Africa and those of the Palestinian people, both of whom never accepted the status of tyranny and oppression, but resisted at all times. In South Africa, we had what was called the four pillars of resistance. And again, we don't say that every country should follow us in respect of all four. The first one, and first and foremost and universal, is based on the primacy of political mass resistance of the people, and that politics leads. In our case, we've seen Palestinians at times adopting methods of armed struggle. We adopted that right to the end. This was reinforced by an underground resistance that could produce the leaflets, that could produce the literature, that could give leadership to the public organizations of the people. And then the fourth pillar, and I'll end on this to keep to time, Martin, was the absolutely vital and important pillar of international solidarity. We had seen this in terms of the struggle that the people of Vietnam in conquering the American invaders benefited from, the moral high ground, the just cause which drew to them the international support of humanity. And this was the case with international solidarity to South Africa. You yourself, Martin, as you mentioned earlier, were a member and a leader of the Cork anti-apartheid movement. We saw the Dunn strike of the workers in Dublin, the store that helped to bring about the Irish government passing legislation to outlaw trade with South Africa. So that BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions, becomes a peaceful but very active and militant weapon to support the struggle of the people. It helped bring about freedom, democracy and justice in South Africa, which is why we of the international community must develop and strengthen the BDS program of action to isolate apartheid Israel and to assist the Palestinian people in achieving justice and peace and a land in which they have the rights and are prepared to share it in whatever way they decide, in terms of all who live there. This was the program for the South African movement. I believe, final statement, that the Palestinian people, in their indomitable resistance against Zionist repression and brutality, will win in the end. And we see them uniting more and more in the struggle, and we see them drawing into the process those fair-minded Jews as well, and it's very important, that factor, to join the struggle for justice and freedom for everybody who lives in the Holy Land. Thank you very much for listening.
You have been listening to Beforum, originating in Cork, Ireland, which featured B'Tselem Executive Director Haggai El-Haj and South African boycott activists Ronnie Castrillo. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.